Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 89.
Sidi Tagal.
That's Somalian.
Happy Monday.
Woot woot. Another week down. It's officially fall weather. We're recording this bad boy from New Hampshire this time.
It is almost my birthday. 32. Ooh, big one.
Very exciting. How are you celebrating this year?
You know, just in Brooklyn on my roof with my neighbors who we're in a bubble with, also have babies. I mean, it's funny because some of my friends had like birthdays back in March and April. I was like, oh, that sucks to have a quarantine birthday. But like, you know, next year will be so much better. And I never thought that my birthday would be quarantined too.
By October.
So, you know, but at least I'm not celebrating a big one.
Speaking of babies, this is the first episode anybody's going to hear some little squeaks and cries from Cyrus, because during our interview with Mukhtar, he was asleep and then woke up, and you'll hear him wake up in the background, and Lindsay jumps off to wonderfully take care of little Cy. But for those of you who've listened to us talk about him, see if you catch it. It's about 40 minutes into the interview part of the episode.
I was trying not to, you know, burp him into the microphone. But you know, it's all about juggling a baby and a podcast. And
we're not literally juggling the baby though.
No. I can barely juggle balls. So.
Having said that though, people who heard that I was trying to get my five ball juggling down over the course of the pandemic, I can now do like 15 to 20 throws and catch them. Not consistently, but I can do it moderately consistently. So, you know, an old dog can learn new tricks, I guess.
I know. My mom was like, do you think Cyrus is going to be a good juggler because he can focus so well? Because he really can hold a stare. At 2.5 months, he can hold a stare. And I was like, I don't know if that's going to make him a good juggler. But what is the trick? Just looking at the top of the throw?
Well, this is actually a good transition. I've been listening to a new podcast for the previous guest of ours, Jay Gilligan. It's called Object Episodes. There's only been one episode so far of it. I think the International Jugglers Association, the IJA, are like putting it out. But it's Jay Gilligan and Eric Asberg, if I'm saying his last name correct. But it's basically them talking about what is juggling, you know, what is dropping, what is throwing, what is, you know, and it's just a philosophical conversation at a very high level about juggling. But what's nice about it is it's kind of like our show, and that it's a little bit informal, doesn't really feel so like heady and academic. They're quite silly and, you know, self-aware with it. So I don't remember your question, but I am trying to get my juggling. I'm listening to a lot of podcasts about juggling. We are not juggling the baby, the most important thing.
You know what also is my dreams were shattered basically of this guy who did the world record, Guinness Book of World Records, and a few people were like, those are, you know, all crap, they're not real. And just like reality TV, you know, my reality came shattering down that it's not real.
Well, you know, getting to reality that is kind of shattered a little bit.
Yeah.
There's been some interesting like reopening news.
There has. And it's in two states that I feel like I would expect it from. The first was Florida.
Two of our favorite states, really.
Really, I know. I went to school in Florida. My family, my parents still have like vacation
winter
down there, so we get to visit them. I love Florida. It's a weird state though, just like New Hampshire. It's a weird state, but Florida is reopening completely. All of the restrictions are gone.
Is that because coronavirus has passed?
No, I don't really know why. Well, I mean, I could muse why.
Yeah.
You know, actually the biggest news is President Trump has
coronavirus. Not touch that on this.
No. But we just have to acknowledge it. And, you know, honestly, actually, the bigger news is Cam Newton, the Patriots quarterback, has COVID. That's really the shattering for me and Josh. That's really the most heart-wrenching one. But Florida is reopened. What's interesting is Florida also has, like, the most older population, right? And but people don't seem to be too concerned about it. And I think people are in their bubbles a lot in the like, kind of retirement communities. So it's hard for them to see that it's actually a thing. Whereas if you're in New York, it's really like, you know, in your face, you can really see it and people take it seriously. And in Florida, it doesn't seem so much like that. But you can go back to
what does that mean
full
for
capacity.
Like shows, so you can just straight up do a 1,000 seat show indoors.
Yeah. Venue. And the craziest thing is it says that businesses can decide to put restrictions on social distancing and wearing masks, but all of the fines and like the state rules of like, you need to wear a mask, you need to do this, have been lifted.
Wow. Well, very, I guess, libertarian point of view. I feel like the other state we're about to mention is kind of taking a bit more of like a halfway ground.
Yeah. It seems a little bit more, calculated is, you know, Nevada. And so specifically Vegas, it seems like they're letting people open up to 50% capacity for theaters, or, so it's like 250 people or 50% capacity, whichever is less.
Okay. So like the absinthe tent could probably go to 250.
Right. Cause if the absinthe tent holds about 800, that would be 400. So they have to do it at 250. And at that point it's like, is it profitable? Is it economically worth it to employ that pretty big show with high caliber performers?
But maybe it's easier to do an 800 seater down to 250 than it is to do 100 seater, which is like where Misbehave was prior to coronavirus, down to 50.
Yeah. I mean, when we saw some of those, I mean, who knows about the Cirque shows if they're like reopening? I mean, we haven't heard anyone's plans yet, right? But like the Cirque theaters hold much more than 800. Well, maybe not much more, but more.
Yeah, they hold thousands.
And, you know, when we saw Ka, it was not 50% full. So I don't know. I mean, it's like, where's the break even and where does it make sense to do it? And my biggest thing is, are people going to come? Because movie theaters, people aren't coming.
But also Florida and Vegas are very different in the who will come. Like, I think there are some old school circuses. Maybe Circus Sarasota is doing this. Maybe I'm saying the name of that wrong. But I think they're like going to reopen under a very limited capacity and sell it essentially as general admission. But they're selling to a local audience, right? Yeah. They're selling to their local regional Florida audience.
Who have really not ever stopped going out, the Floridians.
And Vegas is like mostly tourists and flight travel, essentially, and hotel travel. And that really hasn't picked up again.
No.
So, you know, it's a bit of like the chicken leading the egg or the cart leading the horse. All those just to mix up metaphors. But at least we're now going to start to see experiments in the U.S. of people doing different indoor things. Maybe it's a bad thing because, you know, nothing has really changed. So are we endangering the casts? Are
but
we
that's
endangering
my question.
The audiences?
Nothing has really changed, right? Like, we know masks help for sure. So everyone wear your mask. We know social distancing works.
For sure.
For sure. Outdoor events are much safer than indoor. Air circulation, if you have it outside, much obviously safer with a wind versus inside. So I'm like, nothing has really changed. So are people going to all of a sudden feel comfortable again? Or are they just like over it and kind of like, whatever, I'm just going to go?
I mean, it's kind of like movie theater chains that all opened in August for the movie Tenet, the Christopher Nolan movie, the guy who directed Batman and Inception, and nobody really came. And now it seems like all the movie theaters are actually going to shut down. So they opened for 3 months and now they're shutting down for indefinitely, I guess. Both UK chain, I think the American chain Regal is also doing it. So that's maybe, is that an ode to what will happen to these places that open shows again? We're going to open it, we'll see nobody show up, and then it collapses because it can't stay open.
Yeah, I kind of have a feeling that that's going to happen. I mean, the thing is movie theaters are a little bit different than live performance, because in my mind, you can watch a movie from your computer. You can watch a movie from home. Just wait till it comes out. Live theater, you can't really get that in the same way that you can with a movie.
No.
So, you know, and people were not really going to movies anyway, really, because it's so easy to get it on your computer and at home. So maybe that's the difference. But I do kind of feel like people are going to start going and or opening up, and it's going to be much less people than like, you know, I don't think 250 people will show up every night.
No. And, you know, everyone's adapting, right? Like now we're starting to really see people make change to how they're thinking about doing shows. Different people are trying to put different things up. And it looks like a lot of people are actually turning to teaching mm-hmm. or taking class. Both circus performers that I know who aren't working are taking classes, whether that be like back in their previous academic interests or teaching their own classes. And there've been all these different sort of online platforms. So one I just saw recently is called Circo, C-I-R-Q-O. And that is essentially the same thing as like what Building Block is, Keone Mari's dance program that's online, or another company called Steezy. It's another dance company online, or another sort of hybrid circus crossover dance, Haifa. And they're all kind of the same thing. They're like, be seen, be promoted, take the classes, learn from the teachers. They each have their own kind of subtle difference in like what exactly they're offering into which demographic and with like which kind of philosophy. But the idea that like, okay, we're now available to teach on Zoom and we're going to charge either a subscription or an upfront fee, like seems like a very popular new model. We'll be curious to see like who can make it work as right. opposed to just who can like launch it.
And also who is... Also, like, how sustainable it is. Like, is there an audience past these first few months? As the months go on, does the pool of people who are consuming these programs get bigger? Or is it a finite pool of people? And then as it goes, you've already captured those people.
I don't know. I think it probably depends also on, like, the size of your program, right? So Building Block, which is the dance one, kind of maybe has, like, 10 instructors on it. And,
there are more, I don't know.
And, but it's not one-on-one teaching unless you pay for one-on-one teaching specifically. It's like teaching off of videos. So that's a slightly different model than, say, Rog Academy, which is a juggling online platform school that Book Kennison and a few other people in the juggling scene. I think Errol Emery's a coach on it as well. That's more one-on-one. So that's really just building up like a roster of clients. And maybe if you have 10 people, yeah. that is sustainable. Versus having some kind of subscription model where you're putting out videos and it's not one-on-one. Like these subtle differences, I think, will be what makes it like succeed or not.
Yeah, I mean,
or scale or not.
It makes sense. You got to do what you got to do to stay open. And we've seen so many dance studios closing, and actually House of Yes, which is a great nightclub in Brooklyn, in Bushwick. We actually did our show Slumber at House of Yes right when it opened. And, you know, they have such a... like tried and true audience, I think, and tried and true patrons. And they tried to do outdoor seating with an outdoor bar. They got shut down. And then because there was some weird thing with the food, I don't know, New York State was like, you're not doing right. I don't honestly know exactly the details, but I got an email that was like, can you, like to all their, you know, members, can you donate anything you can or become a monthly Patreon?
Yeah.
And so like that's another model, because they're kind of like putting out videos and doing fun like DJ parties and to on Zoom that you can like be a part of if you have a monthly membership. Just trying anything to pay the rent for House of Yes so they can keep it and be ready to reopen when you can. So like a lot of these artists that don't have, you know, brick and mortar, it's good for them because they're just getting that money right to their pocket.
Exactly. They got no overhead.
Yeah, versus, you know, dance studios who are doing that because they need to pay teachers, they need to pay rent, they need to pay all of that. Like it's a little bit different of a model.
So, you know, we'll see. I encourage people to take classes and like learn stuff, learn like I am, how to juggle five balls. Props to Book Kennison for being my personal juggling coach.
Yeah. Maybe I can teach someone how to talk in a, British. No, I can't do British accent.
No, what's the skill are you going to learn during the pandemic?
Should I? Well, I was thinking how I could get paid. Not how I can pay someone to teach me something. I don't know. I'll have to think about it. Maybe juggling tissues.
Start with tissue juggling.
Yeah. That's what I can learn. Maybe I can learn how to dribble a soccer ball. That was my attempt at a segue into our guest that we interviewed.
Mukhtar, O.S. Mukhtar. And this was an awesome interview. And, you know, considering it's Zoom, I thought the audio came out really well. So for those of you who've, you know, miss our, we record in person in our apartment.
Oh, you said considering it's Zoom, you left the M off. It said,
considering it's like a zoo. But Mukhtar is a super interesting guest. I first heard about him through Spencer Novich, who's a mutual friend. And Mukhtar started out as such a street dancer in London, not dissimilar from the scene that, you know, we always talk about. And ended up getting hired by Cirque du Soleil and worked his way up from being a dancer in a Cirque du Soleil show all the way to their main stage director. Prior to the shutdown, he was directing their Cirque du Soleil soccer themed show called Messi.
That was my dribbling soccer ball attempt. Yeah, he's so interesting and so awesome to talk to. I love when we get to talk to guests who have very similar kind of like taste, I guess, to us, because the conversations are so interesting because you can really like talk about specific things. And he really comes from this dance world that Josh and I just randomly know very well. So watching someone go from that to circus is not very many people.
And not only go from that to circus, but from the essentially the lowest rung of a Cirque du Soleil show, the dancer in it, all the way to stage director over like, what, 12 years, 14 years. He talked about the journey.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I think I saw him in Love. It's unclear. My 21st birthday. But, you know, it's awesome talking to him. I think it's going to be a really interesting podcast for everyone to listen to. But before you listen to our podcast, or after you listen to our podcast and think to yourself, man, I love this podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. We love feedback on guests, guest suggestions, topics to talk about. It's always a really
or if we
fun.
Got something wrong. You know, sometimes people write in being like, oh, actually, that show you said was in their cars. They're actually sitting outside their cars.
That's actually awesome. I love it. Because, you know,
then we know better. Know.
Yeah, it's great.
Anyways, we love you guys. Thanks for listening. Here's our awesome interview with Mukhtar. Mukhtar, such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for joining us over Zoom. Where are we reaching you at the moment?
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to meet both of you. Right now, I'm in Montreal. I've been here for the past four years, I would say.
But guessing from your accent, you don't sound like a Quebecer. Are you, are you an American, a Canadian,
no,
European?
No, I'm actually from England. Yeah, from London. I'm actually from London. I lived in London most of my life before I joined Cirque in the States.
But you're originally from Somalia, right?
Yes, yes. My family's Somalian. And I was, it's crazy. It's a crazy mix. My family's Somalian. I was born in Saudi Arabia. I lived in London most of my life. So yeah, that's
wow.
Basically
you're an international man of mystery.
Yeah, you could say that.
How old were you when you moved to London?
I was about, 8 years old. So, you know, going to a school for the first time, you don't speak a word of English. You know, one of my craziest memories I remember going to school was I had a book that I had to read, but I could only turn the page over when I heard the bell on the stereo. You know, I heard the bell, and because I couldn't read, so you know, I'm just, they're reading for me. So it just shows, you know, the how crazy it is when you go into a country and you don't know the language and you have to learn as fast as you can. Yeah.
So were your parents in the performing arts? What caused them to travel so much?
Not at all. My dad worked with banks. So the reason why we was in Saudi Arabia, we moved there because of his job. So it got to a point where my parents had to make a decision, actually. We went to Kenya for a year and they said, okay, whatever move we make now is for the kids and we have to think about their future. Where do we go? And it was between Canada or England. And it was my mom who really, really pushed England because she felt like she felt the education was better there. She just felt like it would be a better life. So we ended up going there.
Was it an easy transition for your family to kind of uproot and move to
you know,
London?
It's a tough question to answer, I would say, because I was so young. So I'm pretty positive it must have been difficult because my dad spoke a little English. My mom didn't speak any English. And you go to a new country and because he was he also worked for the airport. Before the banks, and he was a translator for 5 different languages, so he was okay with languages.
So
we were lucky on that end going into England, and then he got a job in the airports there. But I can assume for my mom especially, it might have been difficult to adjust because you know who do you speak to? But luckily we had family that were already in England that we can help us transition. But I don't really know how difficult it must have been for them. I can only speak about my experience, what I can remember from being 8 years old. Yeah.
When you were a kid, did you see any like great theater or shows in London that like drove you towards the performing arts?
Nothing. No. Actually, no. I'm the honest. I'm from, I would say, an African family, and for Africans, it's always you know education. They drill into your head, and you have to be a doctor. You have to be a nurse. So I was like that for a while. Even when I went to, we may get to that later, but even when I went to university, you know, I was studying forensic science and that has nothing to do with, you know, entertainment. So I think I wanted exercise. I wanted to do something that would keep me fit. So I started going to dance classes, you know, and that's kind of where my entertainment side began. It had nothing to do with anything before then. And that was in the year, I would say, 1999, 2000, around that. That's when my entertainment world kind of began.
What kind of dance were you studying?
when I first went to a class, it was a Pineapple Studios. If anybody knows Pineapple Studios in England, it's one of the biggest dance studios. And it was a class that was a street dance class that I went to. You know, street dance was cool, and you know, I liked hip hop music, and so I went there, and I started falling in love more with that. And then I really dove more into the styles of popping, locking, and doing choreo. I mean, you know, back then it was urban, but as you said, we don't really, that word urban is a little
being redefined.
Redefined. Yes. That's the best way to put it. Yes.
Well, street dance is an interesting term for it too. I mean,
yes, for sure. Exactly. It's politics, right? Politics in dance, because, you know, people say street dance is, you know, what are the street dances? You know, then you talk about your popping, you talk about your locking. There's crump fit in the street dances. You know what? I was so involved in that politics when I was in that scene. But as soon as I come out of the scene, I feel like I wasted so much time being involved in the politics rather than putting that time towards my growth in dance. You know, like, why are we fighting for what it is? If we love it, if it makes us feel good, let's do it. I'm not saying do whatever you want. Of course, you have to educate yourself in certain elements of dance, but you don't want to look like everyone, you know? And I feel like sometimes politics kind of made us do that. It made us think, oh no, these guys are doing it like this. We have to do it like this. And I felt this is what's killing the creativity in the dance scene, you know? So,
yeah. Well, it feels like it needs to be defined, not necessarily because of the dancers, but it's like the outsiders are like, well, what style of dance is it?
Mm-hmm. You know, and then street dance, you don't think necessarily that should belong in a theater. It sounds like it belongs
on the street.
You know, on a street.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly that. And I can respect why people may think that, because they haven't been told, they haven't been educated, they haven't, you know, a lot of people spend a lot of time complaining, I think, about, and I learned this later on, complaining about what it should be. But you're not doing the work to explain it. You know, do the work to educate the people of what you want without, instead of preaching, try and see it from their point of view and try and explain it like that. And people will take you in. They will take your information in. But if you're telling people what it is, you know, people don't want to listen to that.
So what was the moment where you were like, oh man, don't need to be a doctor. I can be a dancer or a performer. Like, this could work out for me.
You know what? When I went to those classes that I said we started, it was more, now looking back, it's really helped me, my spatial awareness. It really helped me understand, okay, like, I have four people dancing around me. I can't crash into them. You know, I have to know and counts, you know, things like that I did not know existed in, you know, dance. So really, when I say I did not know anything about dance, I really didn't. Like, I enjoyed it. It was cool. I was moving to music and to rhythms I've never done before, you know. So as soon as this was growing, I started a group, a company in England, and it was with a few people in that class, actually, because we just wanted to train. We just wanted to train with each other more because, you know, it's expensive going to Pineapple Studios twice a week, let's just say. So we just said, let's train with each other as well as going to this class, outside the class, let's train with each other. We trained with each other, and then we started, you know, let's try and do a show. Let's try and do this. Let's try and do that. So it started to grow. And we were growing very quick. And the group that we created was called Plague. And I don't know if you're aware of Plague, but we started to do competitions and we started winning competitions. So we started to realize, oh, hold on, we may actually be good at this thing, you know? And we started to do, there was this event. This was of a different set of people, but there was this event called Jump Off as well in the UK. And I always said, if you're able to perform in front of this crowd, you're able to perform in front of any crowd in the world. And it's like you're in a battle arena. You've got people all around you in a circle. People will boo you if you don't do your thing properly. There were like dance battles, booty shaking battles. There was basketball battles. There was, you have to produce and make music on the spot. And if you failed, you would get booed. You know, it was that. So we started to do that. And then what I realized after a while was, hold on, like, I'm studying and I'm also doing this dance thing. I have to pick one. I can't do both, you know. And I still couldn't leave forensic science because I really enjoyed forensic science. I was in my second year at uni. But then that's when Cirque came into the picture. And I didn't know who Cirque was, by the way. I didn't know what Cirque was. And as soon as, it's funny because just to put it into context, when we won the World Hip Hop Championships of the group that we were at, and it was in LA, you know, the World Hip Hop Championships. So we competed in 2005 and we came first. And one of the judges was already a performer in the Beatles show that were in creation at that time. And they were looking for a character that looked like me, that that had to play the Indian love god Krishna in the show, The Beatles. So she saw me and she was like, oh, he might be a good candidate for that. So she phoned Cirque and told them, you should look at this guy, blah, 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 blah. So I get a call from Cirque one time. And it was a guy and who's a director right now at Cirque. He used to work in casting. And he said to me, this is this from Cirque du Soleil. We would love to have you audition for one of our shows because we like the stuff that we've seen from you. And we're the biggest circus company in the world. So the first thing I said was, oh, thank you, but I don't do clown stuff. I'm sorry. So the guy, because I don't know what Cirque du Soleil is, right. You know? So the guy automatically he laughed. And then he said, you know what? Go on our website, look at what we do, and then I'll phone you back tomorrow. So I looked at the website and I was like, oh, damn. Okay. This is bigger than I thought. And you know, in my head, with my family and everything, for me, education was still first, you know, like it had to take something. It had to be something big to really get me off that. So I spoke to my parents and, you know, first thing my mom said was, I thought she was going to say, no, you can't. Because they wanted to fly me over to Canada to audition. So she said, I thought she was going to decline. But she said, speak to your grandfather. Because in our culture, our grandparents are like the leaders of the group or the pack. So I spoke to him and he just said to me, I was really surprised. I was scared nervous, but to be honest, I was really surprised by his response. Cause he said to me, you can go and audition. And even if you get it, you get it, but you have to promise us one thing, that you have to be honest with yourself. Take a year, do it for a year. And if you don't see a future in it, you have to come back, but you have to, there can't be any hesitation after a year.
What an amazing piece of advice from your grandfather.
It was incredible.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of guy is he? Like, is he a normal dude? Did he have an odd job? Is he,
he's one of those guys that when he comes in the room, everybody focuses their energy to him. You know, he's like a shaman, you know, he's the one that always has the great advice. He's always funny. He's always laughing. But you know, you don't want to get on the wrong side of him.
Yeah.
You know? Like he's really that. He had two wives. He's got a lot of kids, you know, like he's a guy who's lived a life, you know. He passed away recently, but he's lived a great life, you know. So that's the sort of guy he was. That's why I was nervous when my mom was like, go and speak to the grandfather, because I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah, so, you were like, mom doesn't want to say no. She's just passing it off.
Exactly. And so to be honest with you, there was a part of me also that was like, say no. You know, because I didn't want to be the one to say no, you know, because it was a big decision to make. But when they said, go, it's a weekend, try it. If you get it, just take a year. I thought, I still wasn't convinced. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go. I went to Canada. I remember I got sick on the plane. As soon as I got there, I was sick and I had to audition, which was crazy. It was funny as well, because they said, can I do over the phone? They said, can you do yoga? Because this position requires you to be flexible. I knew I was flexible, but I didn't do yoga. I said, and of course I said, yes, I could do yoga. And they were like, send me videos. I was like, oh, damn. Okay. So I looked up all the positions of yoga and I just started doing it the best I can. I sent that with my freestyle video. So they brought me over to Canada and I saw the woman who I was talking to. The first time she saw me, she goes, you don't do yoga, do you? And I was like, no, I don't do yoga. So anyway, I was sick. I went there. The choreographer actually was sick, so he wasn't there. So the director was the one that was going to watch me do my audition. He just put on Here Comes the Sun and he just said to me, freestyle for the whole song.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That freestyling is so hard.
Yeah. But I liked freestyling back then. So I was happy with that. I was like, because if you know Cirque, their audition process is grueling. Like it's 3 days. You have to act. You have to dance. You have to pretend you're a monkey on fire. How does that look like on stage? You have to pretend like you're Eminem, but you're a feminist. How does that look like? Like, there's so many things they put in your head that you have to do. Whereas with me, I feel like I got it a little bit lucky because the choreographer was in there and the director just said to me, just dance. just reach out. Yeah.
You can just express however you
exactly.
like to express.
Exactly. Yeah, and
it's great about freestyling. I feel like freestyling is the core, I think, of being able to choreograph in so many ways.
Agreed so much. I mean, freestyle, I think, is the closest form of dance that you feel your spirit. You know what I mean? I mean, you yes. could do choreo. I love choreography.
We were talking about Keone and Mari yeah. before the call a little bit, but when they're freestyling and they're like really in it, or any of the cast yeah. is really in it, we joke that they're like possessed by the Holy Ghost.
For sure,
know, yeah.
100%. And I love watching them, especially because, you know, they're so confident with their body. They're so in tune with every inch of their body. So when they're dancing, they know that they're just following the flow, you know, the feeling. They're yeah. following the feeling. And that's what freestyle is all about. So when I heard that from the director, it was the best thing for me, because I was sick as well. So I didn't want to go through all the hoops. And I wasn't sure. I knew I'm not going to get this. This is a circus company. They're not going to hire a dancer. I'm already lucky. I've been flown over to Canada. I've never seen Canada. So for me, it was a weekend trip. I can just enjoy Canada. So I did the audition for one freestyle to the song. And then he looked at me for like, I'm telling you, this is probably the longest look I've ever experienced. It was like, I'm on the floor breathing heavy because I'm sick. He's looking at me with his hand over his face, just looking at me for, I would say, probably 45 seconds, but it felt like 5 minutes. And then he just said, okay, you got the job. And he walked away. That's it.
Wow.
So in my head now, everything just went upside down. I'm like, oh shit. I didn't even want this job. Like, I didn't know I was going to get this job. And I still, you know, when you go on Cirque's website, they show you glimpses of what they do, but you don't see the true magic behind the company. And they were, at that time, they were rehearsing the Beatles' Love, and nobody was allowed to go inside because it was very confidential. You couldn't hear the music. You couldn't see what was going on. There were security guards at the door, so you couldn't walk in. So when they came to me, I went back to my room and I was like, how am I going to say no now? Because I was like, I don't really want to do this. So I went back to them and I said, I'm sorry, thank you so much, but I don't think I'm going to take this because I'm still at education and leaving my family. It would have been the first time I left somewhere on my own. So I wasn't.
You're what, like in your early 20s?
Early 20s. I was like 21, I think, at the time, something like that. And I was still with my parents then, but thinking about I need to move out now. But in London, I wasn't thinking outside, you know. So they said, they gave me all the DVDs. They said, you're still here one more night. We're going to give you all the DVDs. They even brought me into the creation that they were doing for the Beatles' Love, just to give me a glimpse of what they were doing to get me excited. And they also told some of the cast members who were hip hop dancers as well, who were from my world, to come and speak to me in the evening in the residence, you know? So I think from all of this, I watched DVDs and I just felt loved. I felt like they really wanted me to be there. And then I phoned my mom and then she said, you know, you have to do it. It's 1 year. You're going to live the rest of your life thinking, what if I took that opportunity? You know, like right now in England, we had won the World Hip Hop Championship. We won the UK Championships. We won competitions with our battle crews as well. So what more could I have done there apart from maybe thinking about theater and hip hop, you know? So I just thought, let me go there for a year, learn as much as I can production wise of how I can even create bigger shows. But yeah, 15 years later, I'm here sitting with you guys right now. So that's the story of how I kind of got into Cirque.
As a girl who was interested in forensic science, actually, yeah. when I was going to college, and then I did arts, you know, mm-hmm. performing arts, and I was like, screw forensic, you know, anything else. What were you specializing in? Like, what was it that wasn't the most interesting to you? Because I know forensic science, there's like fingerprinting, there's blood splatter.
I love toxicology. Like, mm-hmm. I really love that. We were studying a lot of that. Criminology as well. We studied a lot of criminology. But for me, it was just, I love problem solving. And it was like, you know, this thing happened. How did it happen? And that's what I really loved. There was things about forensic science I didn't like. All the number stuff, you know, you also have to do a lot of maths in forensic science. I don't mind maths, but it's not my favorite thing. But I think the criminology aspect of things and the toxicology were my favorite. Yeah.
It's funny because it's kind of like directing in a way. You have to like have all these little departments yes. and like get it all together to get this big picture and like exactly what happened.
Yeah.
But like all the details and you're overseeing it.
For sure. It's exactly
that. It's like the same kind of mind.
For sure. It's exactly that. I was thinking that the other day, actually, that you get a whole palette and you have to make sense out of that. You have to, you know, find the solution of how to make it come to fruition. And I mean, it's more enjoyable, I would say, directing performance rather than working
that. Like a murder.
But yeah, exactly. But I think I made the right decision in going this way, because I could always go back to university if I wanted. I don't know if I could always have this opportunity again.
So, you know, my background is circus. And since I was a little kid, I saw Cirque du Soleil and knew instantly that when I was 10, I wanted to do that. And more recently, the last 3 or 4 years, we've been really immersed in the hip hop street, what was called urban dance world. And one of the things I've noticed in that is just how different the culture is between just dancers and circus performers, and the kind of person it attracts, the kind of personalities, the way they talk to one another. So I'm wondering if you can speak to that, and also if you experienced any of that when you, you know, started getting integrated into the circus scene in Las Vegas.
For sure. We experienced that when we first came, you know, the people that are acrobats are the ones that, let's say, own the circus, right? Acrobats and clowns. So when we first came, our show was probably one of the first shows that had an abundance of dancers in one show. I mean, previous shows like Mystère have dancers, and but our show was focused on dance, you know, like, and dance was prevalent when you go and see the show. So there was a little bit of friction at the beginning. I do remember, like, I remember that the director, his background wasn't dance. His background is purely, you know, drama. So he didn't know how to deal with the dancers. The choreographer was a contemporary, very abstract contemporary background choreographer. So he didn't know how to deal with hip hop dancers as well, you know, and I'm not blaming him for anything. It's just, he didn't. We come from completely different background. We're lucky that the director wanted a diverse set of dancers. You know, he wanted the most craziest, contemporary dancers, ballet dancers, hip hop dancers, you know, break dancers, anything that he wanted us to all have our own personalities on stage, which I think was what made the show successful in a way. But dealing with us, that was a whole different situation. And also, how do you deal financially with dancers on a 10 show a week? You know, because dancers are not like acrobats. Acrobats have just finished gymnastics, you know, and this is their retirement job, you know, so they're cool to get paid to do what they were doing before 10 times a week. Whereas with dancers, as you know, we're kind of like divas in a way, where we're like, well, why should I dedicate myself to one job during this time where I could do 5, 6, 10 jobs, you know, going to LA or going wherever? So I think there was that clash in culture where they had to find the right way to deal with dancers. They didn't know, they were approaching us like acrobats and we weren't, you know. So I think that there was that clash. But also learning things. We do things with counts, but in the same scene we have acrobats in there as well, but they don't do anything with counts. So how do we find that balance between the two? And even within other dancers themselves, there's contemporary dancers who don't do nothing with counts. They're more with feeling and just feeling the vibe. Whereas we needed counts. We were like, you just want us to find what this is? Well, we can just go on stage and find it. It doesn't make sense to us, you know? And then there was also a little bit of a clash between the dancers themselves as well. So it took a while. I would say months. It took months for us to really find the way to work together so that we complemented each other well on stage.
One thing I kind of noticed when, because my background is all, well, before Josh, was all theater, musical theater, traditional theater. And that has its own culture as well. And then, you know, the past 7 years has been really focused in circus and then this hip hop dance culture. But the urban dance, street dance, I call it contemporary hip hop. I don't know. It's all about the crew and like the goal of the team and not sticking out because you don't want to be the one to pull focus. It's all about the team.
Yeah.
Versus in circus, I feel like it's a lot of solo acts. Mm-hmm. Like I'm training myself by myself, you know, doing straps. Well, and
that's a good point you make. I mean, I tried to break that, to be honest with you. I tried to break that mold. Like one of the recent shows that I created, we had, you know, the reason why that's tough is because you need time to create in that manner where you can bring everybody together, whether they're acrobats, actors, or dancers. You need time to bring them together. And it got to a point where time wasn't on your side anymore because you just had to create shows within a given time that you were given, and you can't really fail. You couldn't fail because that's millions of dollars on your hands, you know, so you can't really fail. So you have to sometimes play it safe a little bit where you risk 20% rather than risking more than that. But I think it's the coming together of all those elements. I don't know how to put it. Time is the only thing that will make that happen. And I think in the previous show that I did, that I worked with, we had some time. And what I wanted to do, my aim was people couldn't tell who were the dancers or who were the acrobats on stage when they came and watched the show. Of course, unless you see someone do a triple back, you know they're the acrobat. But when people, we had, like, for example, we only had two dancers in the whole 46 cast. But we had a number with 15 people. I called it a movement piece rather than dance, you know, because they weren't dancers, all of them. But you couldn't tell who was the dancer and who wasn't the dancer. And that's kind of what I'm trying to push and break to bring these elements together. Because yes, you can have circus shows where it's just, you know, solos and duos, but that then becomes more of a cabaret. And if it's a cabaret, that's fine. But if you're trying to create a narrative or you're trying to create a direction, you want to break that. You don't want to see individualities really on the stage unless that's their role, unless they're the main protagonist, you know, or they're the antagonist. So I think it's not an easy one. That one is not an easy one. And you've seen it in many shows that people try it. Sometimes they fail, sometimes they succeed.
When did you start getting interested? I mean, clearly you were already interested in a leadership and directing and choreographing position from running the hip hop teams in the UK. But when did it sort of, you know, you're doing Love, you're having a good time. How did you sort of transition to directing and making stuff outside of that show?
Well, like you just mentioned, creating was always my thing. Even when I was dancing in our crew Plague, I was the one creating the shows, and that was more my interest. Even though I was performing on the stage, I loved creating more. So when I went to start working with Cirque, because they didn't know, I don't know if they did it strategically or if they did it because they just didn't know how we moved, they used some of us to create, you know. And of course, I'm going to jump at that opportunity because I love creating. So the choreographer lost his job, I think it was like 2 weeks before the premiere. And they said, okay, we need to put something together right now because we've got a show to open in 2 weeks, you know. So don't get me wrong, I'm not saying he didn't do anything. He did a lot of things, but the problem was he wasn't diverse enough to be able to deal with the different personalities and styles that he had. So what we did was we started creating, we started choreographing together, and everybody, I think that's also when we came together really strongly then as well and bonded. And I think from there, they started to see that I had some sort of ink in creating, in choreographing. And from there, as soon as we opened the show and everything and we got the show stable, for me, that wasn't enough. I was like, yes, I have a job and I'm happy, but I need to use this time to also enhance myself as a creator, because I learned so many new things in that creation because of the production level that I've never experienced before, you know. So from there on, after shows, I would get the best people around Vegas. Vegas had so many artists that were bored to do things, you know. They were in their shows and that was great, but once, you know, once you're in a show, that's it. That's what you do every day, you know, so you're not really growing. So I think I started to work with the likes of Spencer, for example, outside of our shows, and the likes of other artists from other Cirque shows and other, not just Cirque shows, also artists that are in Vegas that are not in any shows, you know, because there's so many artists there. So, and what we would do is Cirque would have cabarets, and I would use people that are not necessarily in Cirque and bring them in so that they can also be seen, because there's so many good talents there. And I think from there, that's where my creativity was growing, because I kept on creating. And then one day Cirque called me while I was still performing with Cirque and said, we have a special event. And it's funny. It was the same guy who was the one that called me for my, for the audition, because he started becoming a director. He was directing them, and he called me and he said, you know, I'm interested for you to come out and choreograph an event that I'm doing. And then they had to ask the show, and that's how they brought me out. And from then on, I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to create more and more. And I think after 2012, it was, I made the decision, okay, I have to go. Otherwise, I'm never going to, you know, be the director that I want to be, you know. So I left and I started that journey.
So how many years were you in Love as a performer?
from 2005, from the audition date to all the way to 2012.
Just before we move on from it, one thing you mentioned earlier was that the role, they were looking for somebody who looked Indian.
Yes.
And of course, you mentioned earlier that your ethnicity is Somalian.
Yes.
Was there ever any like weirdness about that in the process, or was it sort of just like, it's all for the artistic sake, so it doesn't really matter?
There was no issues at all. Many reasons. One, I grew up with a lot of Indians and Bangladeshis from England. So I got that all the time. Are you Indian or are you Bangladeshi or are you? So I got that all the time. So it was nothing new when they asked me that, you know. And then two, no, because I was playing a character, you know, it was nothing for me. It was, if me looking, if you think I look Indian and I can play this role while getting paid to do what I love to do every day, I'll be Indian for you forever. You know, that's the mentality that I had. Yeah, really. I mean, it was a blessing for sure.
Yeah. I don't think also just on bouncing back off that question, when you watch it, I don't think you're like, oh, look, the Indian
dude.
You're
exactly.
absorbing all of it.
Well, exactly. You come out, you know, they're playing Here Comes the Sun. That was the song for my solo. And of course, that's the time when the Beatles went to India and they've got their whole spiritual awakening in India. So people, of course, will relate it to being Indian. But I mean, it is what it is. But then as soon as I start dancing, they're not thinking about that anymore, you know.
I saw Love for my 21st birthday.
Oh.
My trip to Vegas. I don't remember most of it.
Hey, okay. We've seen a lot of those ones in the audience singing and screaming. And we're like, okay.
I don't know if I was screaming because I was like, probably just like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Mm-hmm. But so I have to see it again as an adult.
When did you see it?
Gosh, when I was 21, I was probably like, it was probably 2009.
I could have been there or I could have not been there. I had issues also over my time at Cirque with visa issues because, you know, 2000, because of the whole terrorist attacks and everything like that, they started blocking out people from entering the US that had suspicious names. My name dropped as a suspicious name. So it took long for me to get my visas. So like there was a time, I think 2008, where for a year I couldn't come into the States. So the Cirque were waiting for me to get my visa.
So you decide, I've done enough time on this show. Yep. It's fun, but I got to move on.
Yep.
What, you know, what are the like things you're hitting within this like big Cirque du Soleil empire that like allows you to go up to ending up to directing a full Cirque show? It seems just from somebody who's on the outside of it, how you turn from being like a little cog into like a medium or bigger cog in that organization seems a bit of a mystery.
Well, the thing is, there's a few things. By the time I had decided, okay, I'm leaving, I had already done 3 events with Cirque as a choreographer. So that was already, there was something there where they've seen evidence that I could do what I needed to do. Also, I had done many work outside of Cirque in my spare time, also to show that I want to create, that this is what I do, you know? And one of the examples was what we discussed off air, which was a secret show. We did like a whole hour show in a 2-car garage. So we transformed the whole garage and it was like a multimedia laser inspired dance with acrobatic show.
Was this in Vegas? Just at
in
a
Vegas,
house?
Yes, exactly. At a house.
Oh my God. And I always saw when I was little that the 2-car garages were such a good theater.
We used it. I'm telling you. And we covered like the driveway and we like had everybody sit in the driveway. So it was like 50 people max that can come and see the show. We did it for a few times and people flew over from like Montreal, like Cirque representatives flew over just to come and see the show. And we only did it for like, I think it was 2 weekends. But it was a big, that I think that show was one of the big breakthroughs I think that we did. I created it with a friend of mine that we kept on creating things there. But not just
that.
What
did you call it?
A secret show.
Cool.
Yeah, you can, I mean, it's online. You can go and check out a trailer for it online and you're going to see. Like people don't believe when we tell them this was done all in a garage. Because we also did pre-shooting stuff so that you would see things in Mount Charleston that we did. And the whole fight scene under the pool that we did that we would show. So it was... Thinking back, it was crazy that we had the time to do all of that, but it paid off so well. So because of all of that that I did, it got to a point where Sir came back to me and asked me to come and do another event, which was even bigger than what I had done before. But my show blocked it at the time because they said, no, we need him here to perform. We can't give you the lead. And I just realized then, okay, I have to make a decision now. Like, do I renew my contract when it comes back? or do I say no and pursue my career as a director? And not necessarily a director for Cirque only, just a director worldwide, you know? So luckily for me, when I left, I had been called to work on a show Cirque do called One Night for One Drop. I don't know if you're aware of that.
But sure.
It's a show dedicated to raising money worldwide for people who don't have clean water. And I basically, this was my opportunity now to show we can use any artist from Cirque in Vegas. I think the cast that I had was like 170 people in the cast. Wow. And we used one of the Cirque theaters as well. So the first theater that I did was the NJ1 Theater that I worked on. And then the second show that I did was the Love Beatles because it was, you know, where I came from. So it was perfect. So, but this, I took this as an opportunity to show people like I can create shows, like, you know, there's ideas. And from there on, that's what got me the job to come into Montreal to be a director in Montreal full time for them.
Was it 2 years ago? I forget. Our cast from our dance show mm-hmm. did a piece for the One Drop.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was
the boat
yeah,
piece.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was Andre and Leah's show. They were the directors of the show. And it was the boat piece is one of my favorite pieces that Keone and Marie did. And it was beautiful to see it in the old theater as well.
So cool. Yeah, they don't jump into the water,
obviously.
Exactly.
But it was great.
Cool. And then lifting the boat and you see everything hanging underneath.
Yeah.
That was
such a beautiful image. Yeah. It was great.
I don't want to miss a big Cirque show you've done, but as far as I know, the real pinnacle of directing for Cirque is Messi.
I would say that's the biggest one. I mean, before that, I did a concert for a big European pop star named Helena Fischer, and it was a massive show. That was a big in terms of production, probably might even be bigger than Messi's one. But Messi for me was the biggest because my love for football. I'm from England, so I love football, and the fact that my love of football and my love of creating came together to be able to allow me to create a show. So I would say those two were probably the biggest.
For Messi, did you come up with the idea for it? Or was it the idea was there and they approached you?
Which idea? The idea of the concept of the show or the idea of just having a show on football about Messi?
I guess
the second one. That just the idea of like, we're going to do a show based around a soccer celebrity.
Oh, no, that wasn't me. That was... The head of Sony Latin America basically approached, they know Messi. So they basically approached Cirque and said, you know, you guys did a show on the Beatles. You guys did the show on Elvis. You have to do the show on the best footballer on the planet. You have to, you know, and at first Cirque was not fond of the idea at all. They didn't think that a show could be created bringing sport and art together. So I think they said no at first. And then the producer of a company named Pop Out, one of the greatest guys I've worked with, he came back and he said, you know what, I really believe in this project. There's something there. And they said, let's try and do something. So I wasn't on the project at the beginning because I was working on the concert at that time. You know, there was someone else on the project at the beginning. And I heard that someone's working on this show. And I was like, oh, damn, that would have been great if I was able to work on that because I don't want to miss that opportunity. That's a dream project for me. But I accepted it. You know, I accepted that I'm working on this and when I was working on that, the project collapsed. So I don't know what happened, but they canceled the project. It didn't happen. And then about 6 months later or a year later, they came back and said, okay, we're able to restart the project again. We have the money to do it. Let's go again. So by that time, I had finished doing the concert and my boss came to me and just said, okay, this has come on the table. I know your love for football. I just don't know if you're interested to jump on this project right now. I said yes straight away. I didn't talk about money. I didn't talk about anything. I was like, sign me up for that show straight away. So that's how my...
That to me, if it was assigned to me as a project to like work on, I'd be like, oh man, that is hard. Like just of all the themes to me at doing sports.
Yep.
It does seem like I can see why people were like on the initial face of it, that's a challenge.
Yeah, but this is the type of project like Cirque fans, like I'm talking about diehard Cirque fans, probably will hate because it's like, oh, you're killing the artistic integrity of the company because you're going to try and get easy money collaborating with a superstar, you know, and trying to get there. But for me, I don't see it like that. I see it as another platform to find new ways to create. Like, yes, we're doing amazing things with our shows, with our traditional Cirque shows, and it's great. but we also have to try and branch out and try new things to acquire new audiences, find new ways of creating something interesting. And that's how I saw this project personally. I was like, it's the biggest challenge for me. How can I create something amazing, creative and poetic out of something that's so sport related like football?
Well, once it comes to North America, I believe it hasn't been here yet. Mm-hmm. We'll definitely see it. But I'm wondering, like, what did any like major elements come to mind in the brainstorming creative process where you were like, okay, I can anchor a show based around this story or like this set of themes to do with football?
Definitely,
or soccer?
Definitely. I mean, the first team before I came on, they were working on the life story of Messi. And for me, when I came on, I asked straight away, can I change this story? Because not that the story is bad, but I just feel like it's expected. You know, I feel like, you know, doing a life story on him is expected. And if you're a football fan, you know the life story of Messi. You know that he had issues growing up physically and he had to take shots. And I just didn't want to do that because it was expected. So I thought to myself, what can we do? And we sat around brainstorms a couple of days. And then I thought to myself, you know what would be what I would want to see as a fan? I would want to see what makes a number 10 special. And I think that's what interested me, you know, and what are the elements to make the perfect number 10? And then we explore those elements and we embrace those elements. So, for example, you need to have speed, you need creativity because the number 10 unlocks doors on the pitch. So you need creativity. You need to have great vision to see the game really well. So vision, the element of vision was important. You need great training to be the greatest number 10 in the world. So training was an important element. What else did we focus on? And of course, I added elements of comedy in there as well. Like our main clown was the referee. You know, we had the referee who was a main clown because usually the referee controls the game. But in our show, the more he controls, the more he loses control. You know, usually the referee has to be fit, you know, to keep up with the game. Our referee's fat. You know, so it's like you usually have to be able to see everything. Our referee has glasses. He can't see anything. So I just wanted to take elements that everybody knows about football, or if you don't know about football, you will get to learn in the show and have a good twist on it where you can enjoy it, whether you're a football fan or not. That was one element. And then the other element was I didn't really specifically want to make it right about Messi. Like I didn't want it to be skin and bone about Messi. I wanted it to be a show about football, you know, and we're celebrating Messi rather than this is Messi. And that would be the life story of Messi. And you can't really reach a lot of people with that. Whereas you could reach a lot of people if it was celebrating the sport of football that's really paying focus to Messi, if that makes sense.
Totally. And of course, you know, being on a audio only medium, a little hard to describe visuals.
Yeah.
But I did see it's quite a cool stage. It's basically like a soccer pitch that sort of banks up on either.
Yeah.
And it's arena touring.
Yes, right? exactly. And the main inspiration with that was I said to the set designer, how can we make people feel like they're coming into a stadium and they feel the element of a pitch in front of them, but it's not a pitch, you know? So that's why we had the design of the pitch, you know, the rotation on the stage allows us to deconstruct the lines of the pitch. We also had the two tunnels on either side where the players come in and out from when they go into the game, whereas for us, the game is the show. So there's a lot of football had to be infused in the creation of the show rather than we're going to do a Cirque show and we're just going to put the football on the stage. You know, it had to be more than that. One of our characters, we called it the Flea. The Flea is the nickname of Messi because he's so small, but he's so nimble and fast. And it's a mechanic football that moves on itself on the stage. And it interacts with the people on the stage. So football was very important in really making it work.
So is that the first real like robot in a Cirque show?
We had a robot in Luzia. I don't know if you've seen Luzia, but
I did. What's the robot in Luzia?
You remember the beginning? I don't know. Maybe they took it out by the time you watched the show, but they had at the beginning, they had this little robot that was flowering that was watering all the flowers at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
So, maybe
I remember the big horse puppet. That was a puppet.
No. But even in the same show that I did with Messi, we also had a cooker arm robot as well. So we did a whole performance with an acrobat with a cooker arm. And that focused that whole.
So you say cooker arm, is that like the kind of arm that like you see in like car plants?
Yes, exactly.
That, like, yeah.
Exactly. That build cars. Exactly. So we basically had a whole performance around it. And what we were celebrating there was the gaming element of the football world, you know, playing the computer game. So you had a couple of kids, you know, turning the game on, and then it was Messi versus Machine, which is him facing himself. Nice. So that was the robot versus the number 10, which was cool as well.
So you're hanging out in Montreal, making shows, yeah. you know, living the dream, and then all of a sudden, pandemic strikes.
Yeah.
What was that like for you being in the middle of that, the shutdown, how you've been using the last essentially 6 months?
It was, everything happened so fast because I was working on the latest Big Top show that Cirque were going to release like in April. And when it happened, I remember thinking, interesting. Something like this has never happened. They've sent everybody home and we don't, the reaction I got was, we don't know when we're coming back. So I didn't panic, you know, like a lot of people panicked. I didn't panic like a lot of people. I just thought everything happens for a reason. I left, I went home. And then, you know, they told a lot of people after a specific time that, okay, everybody would have to lose their jobs because, you know, no shows are happening right now. All the shows have stopped. And even at that phase, I wasn't stressed. You know, I was like, okay, we've lost our jobs, but people need entertainment. Entertainment will always be around no matter what happens. Even if for the next year we don't have entertainment, it will come back still, you know? So I still didn't panic while people were panicking, of course, and understandably so as well. I'm not going against that. But I think what I thought of straight away when we got into there is, right now I have time I've never had for a long time. I never had this much time for a long time. What can I do? And again, I still reverted to creating. So what I did is I contacted, Spencer was one of them. I contacted 10 people that I knew were great artists. And I said, let's create a video, a quarantine video that showcases what artists are doing right now in the life of quarantine. I don't know if you've seen that video, but
I did. I saw the New York Times write up about it
exactly.
as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was, but we didn't, we just did it so that we can send positive energy out into the world at this time where it was really negative at that time. But we, to our surprise, it picked up really well and it went viral and a lot of people were talking about it. So that, for me, that was my mindset. You know, it was like, even in this negative time, we still have to find ways to create. Yes, we're not necessarily making money, but, We could still grow. We can still grow even if we're not making money. And that was my mentality. And after that, we created another video as well on, because there was that whole BLM situation with George Floyd. So we created another concept, but this one was more focused on dance. And then after a while, I got a gig where we were creating a concept for a show that would happen in China. And this is outside of Cirque. So I've been working on that for a while. So that was a nice income that was coming in for that. But still gave me time to do other things as well. So for me, to be honest, I would say I'm a little bit lucky because I've been affected by it, but at the same time, I'm trying to find the positives in this negative, you know, until we find our new reality, I would say, because I don't think it's going to go back to what we had before.
Yeah, I think at least for the next 2 years, we're going to see some weird new thing. And maybe in like 2022 or 2023, we'll see it look theoretically like maybe it could look now.
Yeah.
But Fauci, the U.S., everybody knows who Fauci is, basically said he doesn't think theaters will be back to normal until a year after the vaccine is released.
Wow.
Because it will take that long for people to all get it. Essentially,
that's scary. You know, when he says it like that, it's scary. I mean, and when I say it's scary, I'm talking about all the small circus companies, all the small dance companies, all those companies that are not going
to
be.
Don't you feel like the small ones can do more than even Cirque can? Like Cirque or these big ones have to cross all of these business thresholds. While if it's just a bunch of circus performers, bunch of dancers, they can go and do a show in a garage and figure out.
Yeah,
you're right.
You're right. But there are small circus companies that are renting out big studios. Like they've got big circus spaces, you know, so they have to pay that rent that they've bought. They've bought those circus spaces. So if you're not making money on any shows, how are you paying for the space, the rent and all of that? So they're going to lose their home of where they're building their shows. I'm talking about like your Seven Fingers, for example. I'm not saying they're small, but they're smaller than Cirque, you know?
And sure. Or LWAS, for example.
Yeah. These guys have a place where they're training and they build their shows. But if they can't pay their rent there, how are they supposed to keep going? And that's what creates the culture. You know, companies like that create the culture, the circus culture. So I'm more concerned about those companies. Yes, even if Cirque go down, I mean, they will find a way to come back. You know, they will find a way because the brand is too strong. They will find a way. But I'm more worried about the guys that don't have a stronger brand and don't have a bigger reach in the world. So, I mean, look at Cirque right now. I mean, they've got no shows running, but they still manage to, you know, air shows every Friday on their YouTube channel. And there's millions and millions of people that are watching that. You know, it's not as big as it was at the beginning when they played it, but they still have that reach, you know, even without doing any shows. So,
yeah, I mean, it would be very interesting to see like what would have happened to Cirque in these conditions had they not been purchased and had all this private equity debt on top of them and leveraged loans. Like, for sure, it would have been a similar like we can't perform kind of situation. But whether or not like the bankruptcy would have played out the way it has.
Well, the bankruptcy, I mean,
totally different.
Yeah, I mean, the bankruptcy thing, I mean, that's for them, that they're protecting their assets, you know, like they didn't necessarily file for bankruptcy. They filed for protection against bankruptcy. So they were.
Yeah.
So they were so that people couldn't come and take their big tops and take the equipment that they had. And they did that until they got bought. So now they've been purchased. There's new owners that are coming in, but nobody knows what the new owner's mandate is. Nobody knows what does the new owners want to do in the next 3 years, 4 years. You know, is everybody going to be fired? Or I say fired, but is everyone going to be let go and Cirque becomes a company where they're just hiring freelancers to do things rather than having people on salary? Because then that affects a lot of people. And then, you know, like for me, for example, then is there a reason for me to be in Montreal if that happens? Because they can always hire me from Vegas or London or wherever. So I think these decisions that these new owners coming in that are going to make are going to affect thousands of people. And we'll just see what that is. But right now, it's a gray zone. Nobody knows what that is.
Yeah. And I think it'll probably be a little bit of time before we even really know. Because it's going to be a whole management transition. We talked about offline a little bit that the board head of the board stepped down. But you're right. There's enough of an enormous fan base for Cirque du Soleil and a brand there that it will be very difficult for it to actually
stop. Yeah. But I mean, but they will have to come back smaller. They'll have to come back with smaller teams, but more creative ideas, I would say, because, you know, when you don't have money, you have to be more creative to create successful things. Like you can't blag. Sometimes when you have money, you can blag it because of the production value of the show, you know?
But you could also, just throwing it out there as an alternative plan, you could totally bail on the making new creative things and say, all right, we're going to open like 3 O's,
which is what they're
going to
do. You're right. Which is exactly what I'm sure that's what's going to happen because it's the smartest thing to do. Okay, let's not spend money. Let's just get our shows up and running so that we start making money again. And then let's think about what choices to make and bring in new shows out. So that's why I always say, instead of panicking and waiting for people to come and put food on your plate, you have to go out and put food on your plate yourself. Like, don't wait until your show comes back. Don't wait until hoping that you're going to be creating later on for them. Go out and look what's happening in the world right now and adjust yourself to the new reality. Adjust to it. Don't fight it. If you fight it, it's going to leave you. You know, that's how I look at it.
So jumping back a couple of steps just towards like directing and choreographing, obviously everybody has a different approach to it. I listened recently to Franco Dragone, who's a Cirque du Soleil director who did many of the early years genius. For those listening. Of course, you know who he is. But he talks so much about how like he imagines these Cirque du Soleil scenes as like paintings, you know, creating these like large visual images. I'm wondering, you know, if you can just speak to people who are, there's not a lot of resources for circus directing. So it's a little bit about your methodology. If you're the kind of person who writes stuff or draws stuff or, you know, creates it all based on improv or comes into the room with it all choreographed in your mind already.
Yeah.
How do you, you know, strike that balance?
I think for me, when I'm creating, I have to, first of all, what is the intention? I always look at that first. What is the intention that I want the public to feel? Like, what do... When you leave my show, what do I want you to feel when you leave your show? Happiness? Are you questions? With the type of shows that we create with Cirque, I mean, happiness is always number one, and feeling like joyful, you know, feeling joyful when you leave. But when I'm working directly with people, like, I need to find what's special about those artists, you know, like that. And I'm the type of director that likes to get to know the artists. You know, I want, by the end of the project, I want to know who you are. I want to know your name. I want to know if you have kids. I want to know, you know, what sort of personality you are. Because that, for me, that helps me in knowing how much to push you and knowing how to get the best out of you. If you don't know who the people are, how can you get the best out of them? I don't understand that. So that's one important element for me. And then the next thing is, as Franco said, it's all about what pictures are you trying to create on stage? You know, what do you want for your public to see? And what can you create that they can connect with? You know, what are certain pictures that everybody can connect with as a collective? You know, everybody feels the same way when they see a sunset. You know, everyone feels the same way when it's gray skies and it's raining. You know, you feel, I mean, yes, it attacks people differently, but the majority, it's, I'm staying in, I'm relaxed at home. So these type of situations you bring and you use it, I like to use those type of emotional situations on stage and see if I can connect to people that way. And I think I look through that. Yes, Cirque du Soleil shows are not narratively driven like a Broadway show or a West End show. It's not about speaking, and it's not about, you know, it's universal. But at the same time, the emotional drive that we're giving the public, that's the most important thing now, because it's not a story that we're telling you from A to Z, you know? It's feelings that you can't explain, but you feel when you're watching the show. You know, you go to watch Car, it's this crazy, extravagant show where you're seeing things you've never seen before, stage rotating 360. So you're feeling awe when you go and see that. When you go and see the Beatles Love, it's all about love and joy. You feel that when you come out. When you go to Mystère, you feel the magic of Cirque, I would say, the spirit of Cirque. So each show has its own unique gift that it gives public. And I always look for that when I'm creating. What is it that I'm giving people? And that's why Messi, going back to that, that's why that was interesting for me, because it was new tools, new ways to create. Can I find a new emotion to give people here? Can I make people feel inspired to go off and be the best at what they can be? Not necessarily as a footballer, but wherever you are. If you're a banker, you know, you could be the best banker you are. What are the elements that make the best banker, you know? And then take that elements and make yourself stronger. So I wanted people to feel inspired coming to the show. So I think for me, it's all of those things. And the most important, treat your artists with respect. That's for me the most important, like that you're not their boss. You're working with them to create something magical or something beautiful. And people will not work and give you everything unless they see that you're honest and that they see that you actually care about them and you care about what they can do and you respect what they can do. I feel like a lot of creators miss that point very quick because I'm the director. I sit back. Everybody else does my work for me. I don't work like that.
On the flip side of that coin, is there a kind of performer or artist you particularly look for when you're casting or that you like to look with? Are there personality traits?
Yep. When I look and when we're doing our castings, sometimes, of course, we don't know performers and we bank, you know, we risk based off their skill. Because sometimes, you know, you could have them, you could be the best performer in the world, but you're an asshole. Sorry, my French. But
it's all good.
You know what I mean? You're not fun to work with. So my best artists to work with are artists that are collaborative, artists that love to propose, artists that tell you, I see what you're asking me to do, but look at this. You know, I've got this. I think this might be a better direction. I like to be challenged. Some people don't like that. Some people just want you to do what they tell you. But I like when artists tells me, I see where you're coming from. I think this could be a better direction. Have a look at it and tell me what you think. And there's a lot of artists that I've picked that I've worked with that are like that. I don't know if you know Claudio, who was a long...
He's a clown?
Yeah. One of the best from Cirque. Yeah,
was he the original clown in Varricon?
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Incredible artist. Like, I've worked with him a few times, and not on a big, crazy show, but just some of the small shows that I like to do, like the quarantine video. He was in that. He was a clown in that. He's someone who's very gracious with his creation. Spencer, another one, very gracious with their creations because they know it's bigger than them. They know it's not about them. It's about what are we creating together, you know, that is going to touch so many people. And I think those artists are the best to work with.
Well, Lindsay just joined us for this podcast. Yes. She was quickly putting baby to sleep in the last 10-15 minutes.
So good.
Welcome back. We've covered a lot of good ground.
I know. I could hear Josh's questions, but not the answers.
Okay. So you have to listen to the podcast to find out.
For real.
Yeah. I heard you ask a question about, like, what's your process of directing? Mm-hmm. Did you ask, like, the question of how you, like, so some of the most fun moments, I think, are, like, coming up with ideas for mm-hmm. shows. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, this would be a good show, or this, like, topic mm-hmm. or this, you know, storyline. Like, where do you start when you have an idea for a show? And, like, how does it evolve? Like, do you have someone who you play off of? Because we obviously talk to each other, me and Josh. But
well, for me, I'm in that process right now, actually. Like, I'm working on two or three different projects at the same time. And I feel like the concept is great, what we have, but we're trying to find what is it, that thing that's going to grasp people in this concept, you know, like what is the story, or what is the message, or what is that? Then that's what we're trying to find right now. And what I found is it's more difficult now to find those, because we're not around people physically. Like, when you're around people, you can bounce off them. Now I bounce off my wife, which is good as well. But when I'm at work, you know, there's people, specific people I know I can bounce off. And if they tell me, oh, I'm not sure about that, then I kind of trust their judgment, you know, and I ask them why, and from there we find. But for me, it's a tricky one, because finding what's right, you can never find it at the beginning. If it excites me, then I know there's something there, you know, for me anyway, I know there's something there. And I just hope that other people feel that way too. Like, you know, like, there's one concept I'm working on right now that is taboo, is provocative. Like, you know, some people may not even like it because of, you know, what it is, but it excites me because I'm thinking in 5 years' time, it's not going to be taboo anymore. In 5 years' time, everybody's going to be doing it. So I'm like, let me tackle it now when people find it taboo, and let people ask questions. Let's have the discussions. And then 5 years' time, when it's fine and everybody's doing it, then I was ahead of the curve. You know what I mean? So those type of things excite me. And I think finding the story or the narrative is the easy part for me. For me, it's finding the idea that's the tough part. It's what is the idea that's different from everything that we're seeing right now? And that will make people think, when they see it on their screen or they see it, someone says it, makes them think, oh, I never heard that before. I'm really interested to go and see that. Like, Hamilton is a good example. You know, I would never, if you told me that script of, yeah, they're talking about the history of America using hip hop, it would not have excited me. Like, I wouldn't have said, oh my God, I desperately need to see this. But the type of hype that everybody's been talking about it, now I'm interested. I still haven't seen it to this day, but now I'm really interested to see it.
Well, the ultimate thing for, you know, folks like yourself who have such a dance background, I think when you watch Hamilton, is it hits all of the hip hop categories except in the choreography.
That's
where
it
is very Broadway style choreography.
But this is what kills me, like, because everybody was like, oh my God, you have to watch it. Like, everyone, you know, everyone that works with me, they're not from a hip hop background. So everyone's like, you have to watch it, right? Because you're from a hip hop background, you're gonna love it. So I just, you know, looked up on YouTube and I just saw some of the dancing, and I'm like, this is just like what everybody who thinks they do hip hop is hip hop. This is what they
Broadway, it's the Broadway version of
hip hop. Exactly. Yeah. And but maybe it's the story that's really incredible, and maybe, you know, the way that the artists are acting and the passion, maybe that's what's amazing about it. Not so much the dance, but to people who don't know hip hop, for them the dancing is incredible as well.
Listen, it's on Disney Plus now, so you really have no,
I have no
excuses.
And I have Disney Plus, so I have no excuse to watch. I will watch it. It's just time.
There was a show, I can't remember the title of it, but it was on Broadway. It lasted, like, I don't know, a few months. It was in a theater that I was working for, and it was a Tupac musical.
Oh.
And it was, like, the musical of his, or it was, like, about his life with hip-hop narration and some of his music. And it was, like, way before Hamilton, and it didn't last long, and it didn't do well, because I think people were like, hip hop on Broadway. But I think the trick of, like, introducing a new idea or like genre is, like, how do I do it in an accessible way? Yeah. So even though Hamilton is a hip hop musical, it still feels super Broadway and traditional.
That's the only way it could be successful. That's the problem, because people don't want to accept real hip hop. This is the problem, right? You know, like it doesn't interest them. Real hip hop doesn't interest them. So they have to find a way to water it down so that it can appeal to the masses. I've been trying to do a hip hop show with Cirque for God knows how long.
Well, come see Babel. I think we cracked it with Keone and Mari.
Oh, really? Amazing. I would love to see that. I would love to see that.
I mean, it's back circus, open again.
Once it opens, exactly. No, but like if you look, like let's say the brand of Cirque coming together with a hip hop, it doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't. It's not something you would put together. So we've been trying it for a long time and it hasn't. The closest it's been is the Beatles Love. And it's not necessarily hip hop. It's just, we're just doing choreo. There's some locking in there. There's some breaking in there. And there's some popping in there.
I did see, you know, you're talking about when you were with Baby, that Cirque is posting all these videos to YouTube like every week. They just did do a recent like best of Cirque dance video.
Yes.
And there's a show that they toured in India for a little while called Bazaar.
Yes.
And that was, to me, I was like, oh, snap. This is like kind of hip hoppy, streety vibe for the first time. But only if you were in India would you have.
Yeah.
Or Saudi Arabia, I think, have
they
seen
did,
it.
They did Saudi Arabia, India, and they did a couple of other. But even then, was it hip-hop? Because if you look at the dancers, none of the dancers apart from the B-girl were hip-hop dancers.
And that's breaking, dancers. Right? So that's even...
that's what I'm saying. So none of them were really. And so it really comes down to, you know, how authentic are we going? It comes down to, yes, if a normal public watches it, for them, that's hip hop or that's street dance. Mm-hmm. But it's not that easy for me to buy into that.
Just for my own curiosity, have you ever crossed paths with this guy, Dylan Mayoral? He's a British hip hop dancer.
You should look him up.
Put him on your radar.
Dylan Mayoral?
Yeah. Dylan Mayoral. I'll send you a link to him afterwards.
Perfect.
He's in our show.
He's in our show, but he's super theatery trained. Oh, okay. And
maybe
trained.
He probably came the generation after.
He's
I
maybe
left
like 24 now.
Yeah, he came after.
Now.
He came after I left.
I'll send you his stuff. But he seems like he's in the generations, you know, following your footsteps.
I would
in
love
a weird
to see.
Way.
I'm always trying to look at who are the new people that are coming up. I'm always trying to also give platforms to people I know are great from when we were performing that I know can do things on this platform, but they will not get that time just because they're not lucky to get that time. So I'm always like, the last show I did, or 2 shows ago, I used Nagin, for example. I don't know if you know B-Boy Nagin. He's like one of the best B-Boys in the world. He's from Brazil. He does capoeira with his b-boying.
Oh, cool.
And he danced with Madonna for a long time. But even him, like, you know, I want to tap into the street dance community, the hip-hop community, and take people out and bring them into the, I wouldn't say mainstream, but bring them into the circus world. Because I believe there's a lot that people have to offer. Keone and Marie. I tried to work with Keone and Marie before, but they're busy. They're busy cats. You know, they're so sought after.
Yeah, we don't, you know, obviously they do their own things, but we try to maximize as much of their schedule as they'll allow us.
That's smart. But, I think I tried to work with them twice and they want to, but it's just, the problem is when we get project, it's special events.
Well, you said it earlier, literally perfectly, the culture between circus and dance, and all of, we struggle with a similar thing of dancers being like, okay, great, I got Babel for 6 weeks, 12 weeks, 24 weeks. But like, I also got this like great gig in China.
That's
I would like love
saying.
To take this weekend.
I'm like, no,
know?
you're in this show.
That's what I'm saying. It's difficult. It's really with dancers. It's really difficult because they do 10, 15 things at once. You know,
The idea of sticking to one show is just like insanity for them.
Exactly. But I was saying, but with them, all they had to do was not to perform, but as choreographers. Yeah, as choreographers, of course. But even that, they were really busy. They were on like 3-4 projects at the same time. They had maybe 2 weeks here, a week here, but we couldn't do that. You know, they have.
I know the fact that they're. It's funny because you know they perform in the show. They're the leads in it, mm-hmm. And we were like, "Are you gonna want to do that?" And they were like, "Yeah, we never get to dance."
Wow.
And you know, I think like after a while, they were like, "We need to like take a break," and we're like, "That's fine." But then they take a break. They see the understudies go in, and they're like, "Oh, we want to go back in for."
They're like the greatest couple I've seen, man. When it comes to like dance and their chemistry together, and of how open. I don't really know them, but like I just see them from outside, like everyone else. But how open they are with their issues as well as their
they're the
their
same
good
people
points.
On the social media as they are. are in person. I would say there isn't really a big a huge gap between the internet and who they are.
That's respectable. But
you know, the one nice thing, as somebody who's married a couple of them, we're a couple working them, they are a real couple. You know, they do have their own, you know, who gets to choreograph this moment and who doesn't. That's amazing.
I would love to see that. I would love to see them arguing about that. But it's the same. I mean, it's interesting watching couples work for me.
Yeah.
You know, Tabitha and Napoleon, that's another two.
Yeah, so precede them, really. Yeah.
It's also nice to work with a couple because when you have tiffs, you know, as you know, like with your wife or your husband, and if you do it in front of people who don't really work with their significant other, it's like uncomfortable.
Yeah.
If you have two couples doing it and you're like, oh God, like just listen to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, I see that.
It's tricky. It's tricky. But at the same time, it's great. Like if I know that I can work with a couple, it's better for me because that's two great minds that I can split and give different tasks to, you know, like, you're getting two for the price of one, basically. You can have one choreographer, or you can have two that are amazing that you can, that doubles up your work even more. So, I mean, I work with, I don't know, Andre and Leah. I don't know if you know them, but they were directors of that One Drop show. And it's just great to have that tool of two people who have different skills, but they're on the same wavelength. It's really cool.
Well, I think this is a great spot to head to our last three questions.
Yes.
This has been an awesome chat. The first question, and all of our guests get these same three questions, is, has somebody given you a piece of advice, either really, really good or absolutely terrible, that has stuck with you?
Although your grandfather gave a really good piece of advice.
I would say my grandfather, that was a good one of, you know, give you a year, be honest to yourself. If you don't see a future in it, come back. But then there was also another advice that I got, and it was from a friend. And it was like, and it was around the time I was performing as well. And they just basically said that at the end of the day, no one is going to, because I was going back and forth in my head, you know, do I leave? Do I not leave? But they just told me at the end of the day, nobody cares about your future more than you do. You know, if you want to shape your future, you have to do that yourself and do what's best for your future. So I think that for me, that was a big one that stuck with me, because we spend a lot of time taking advice from everybody and doing things maybe subconsciously because of what other people are doing and not really thinking about what's good for us, you know? And I think that stuck with me. Like all the decisions now I make are based on what does this decision do for me and my career, and what does it do for my family as well? So I think I take that with me all the time.
Great.
I don't remember a really bad.
That's good. You should try to forget the bad ones, unless you're purposefully doing the opposite. Second question, for somebody who is a student of circus, or in this case, dance as well, is there a book, a movie, a live show when live shows return that really inspired you that you would recommend somebody check out?
A show or a book or anything like that?
Any piece of media or art, piece of art.
That inspired, there's been quite a few things. I mean, I'll tell you, the show that inspired me, that made me think, whoa, like I could do something serious with my craft. And this was when I was choreographing and directing dance, was a show called Bounce that I watched. I don't know if you know Bounce. It's an older show. It started in London and started touring, but it was like, it's the first show I saw where there was theater into street dance and hip hop. Like they were telling stories with the style. And I was like, what the hell? I was just used to, you know, hip hop international, you know, you're performing in front of the public and you're just doing your best moves and you do the best tricks and you just
like
blow
those 8 minutes.
Yeah. You blow the crowd away and that's it. And I even pushed the 8 minutes to like, I don't know, 60 minutes, you know, but still, I mean, it was a show. But to see and to kind of live in the moment, I think that's what was my weakness at the beginning. Being afraid of silence, being afraid of nothing happening on stage. You know, like for me, I was like, no, we have to fill this. There's a gap on the stage. We have to fill it. Whereas we shouldn't fill it. It's a nice gap that lets people relax, breathe, and be ready for the next emotional rush we give them. I think that's what that show showed me that I watched. And I think that was my inspiration, but I don't think people will find that because it was so long ago. And it was, I don't think you're going to find it on archive. It's before YouTube and all of that. So I don't think you will find that.
Well, somebody, so if anybody's listening, digs it up, send it, send it in.
Did you ever see Frankenstein at the National Theater in London?
No, I didn't get
to see that. Talk about silence on stage. The first 10 minutes is him being born and learning how to walk.
And we watched it.
They streamed it
naked.
Live.
He's naked. As
Are you serious?
Yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch, totally butt naked.
Oh, it's him. Okay, no, I didn't see that. But that was recent then. That was
I think they did it in 2013, but they aired it as part of the coronavirus, like, funding the National on YouTube.
Was it good?
It live.
In person, it was amazing. On video, it didn't read nearly to the degree.
I was like, is it bad to fast forward?
Oh, but I get it, right? I can imagine you sitting in the theater, not knowing what to see, and you see somebody naked for 10 minutes on stage, just like learning to walk. That's different from watching like 10 minutes of video where you can like scrub forward and you're like, okay, I get it. Like,
and if it wasn't Benedict, like if it was someone else, like would it have the same power? Could they afford the same amount of time of silence? That's another thing, you know?
Yeah. Right. Cause there's no like underscoring. It was literally silence and his grunting, like
that's weird.
Hearing him hit the, it's an interesting like lesson or like, you know, kind of exercise of like how do you get birthed and like learn.
I'm intrigued. I want to see it.
You should see it.
I just want to see that, you know, that just that whole silence at the beginning and just see, is that silence justified? Like do they get you desperate for something to happen?
They get you desperate for like, let's move on to the next.
Okay, but in a good way or a bad way?
No, I think
I thought the show in person when I watched it in person was like one of the most amazing things I've seen. And then when I watched it on video, I was like, this kind of looks like anything else on video.
All shows are like that. I think all shows are like that. I mean, some better than others on video, of course, visually, but all shows are, you can't watch. It's not the same watching live than watching on video.
No. That's why I just am dying for a live performance to come back.
Yeah.
It's soul crushing. I have to wait
a little bit longer, but
we'll crack it one way or another.
That's what I'm saying. We're thinking of ways. How can we do something without bringing everybody in a group, you know, like we even had ideas maybe with Cirque. Can we do something where we create a show within the headquarters of Cirque because there's nothing happening in the headquarters, you know? So people get to see where we create, but at the same time, you're seeing performance on top of performance, the area. Yeah. So, but it's difficult because we have to make sure we manage social distancing. We have to make sure we manage people's safety. So it's not easy, but it's possible. It's not impossible.
It's true. It's not impossible. It's just now about like reframing how you think about live performance.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But our last question, which you sort of answered a little bit and we told you to save it.
Yes.
Is who do you think we should have on the podcast?
I think you should have a good friend of mine. His name is Gabriel. And he's been in Cirque all his life, actually. His dad was the baby for Mystère. Did you guys get
Mystère? Yeah, sure. I've seen Mystère twice. That's crazy. Okay.
So his dad was the baby.
The OG baby?
Yeah, the OG baby. Exactly. So if you like, he's got stories upon stories because he grew up, you know, on the creations of like Zoomanity, the creations of Mystère. He was always around that. He was in Vegas all that time. And the Cirque high, I call it like the heyday of Cirque, you know, he was there around all of that. And because of all of his knowledge and everything that he's acquired over the past, he's a creation director for shows, and he's able to give you his insight. At the same time, he's also a fighter for people as well, because, you know, when all this craziness happened with Cirque and people wanting their money and being paid their money, he was the one that really took a risk, you know, came out, you know, he's the face, his face was on all the news reports saying, you know, that he was there, basically the head of the resistance of the people. So maybe it might be interesting for you guys to have a discussion with him and just, you know, peek into his mind a little bit, because he's an interesting fella, that's for sure.
Yeah, it sounds awesome.
Yeah, he's a really great guy. Yeah. You should just speak to him.
Well, Mukhtar, thank you so much for spending the time to chat with us. This was such a pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'm sad I missed the middle part of it.
But I hope I get to see Messi when it reopens and you know, all these other projects you're cooking up in this development time.
I have a random jersey of Messi.
Oh, you do?
That's it. You can wear that to the show.
It's like the one player I knew.
But that's what I'm saying. Messi, that reaches everybody. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
It's crazy.
For sure.
No, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be on here and to speak to you guys. Thank you for having me. It's great to be able to share and remember things as well that's happened in my past.
And that was our interview with Mukhtar.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. and have a good week.
Catch you on the next one.
Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.